I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, the year was 1999, and it was the end of the century, and for some, it seemed like the end of good taste in American pop culture. Fist fights, name-calling, and infidelity was hot. It made Jerry Springer America's top daytime program. Beanie Babies were presented as wise investments against economic uncertainty, and Y2K promised but didn't deliver a release from the tightening grip of computers and the fledgling internet. It was a year where the lines of reality began to blur, where showmanship mattered more than craftsmanship, and sizzle mattered more than the steak. Journalist Ross Bennis looks at the explosion of low culture in mass media in the late 1990s. His book is 1999, The Year Low Culture Conquered America and Kickstarted Our Bizarre Times. That's what's coming up on The Source.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
From the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In today's society, critics often lament the state of pop culture, calling it crass, coarse, cheap, and devoid of merit. From reality TV's shameless spectacles to viral social media fights, it seems like culture has traded substance for sensationalism. But how did we get here? The answer could be found in a single year, 1999. That was the year when the cultural floodgates truly burst open. The reigning king of daytime television, The Jerry Springer Show, turned human conflict into entertainment, normalizing public humiliation and tabloid-style trash.
Welcome to the show. My guests today say they must reveal their secret affairs to their lovers. Please meet Shauna. She says she was seeking revenge after finding out that her lover was having a secret affair.
This is the argument of author Ross Bennis. He looks at the explosion of low culture in the mass media in the late 1990s. His book is 1999, The Year Low Culture Conquered America and Kickstarted Our Bizarre Times. Why did you decide to take on this topic?
Well, I would just notice little things pop up in our culture that mimic the trashy entertainment that I liked as a kid. So the theatrics of 1990s pro wrestling would certainly show up in our presidential administration. It'd also show up on Fox News and on CNN. And Beanie Babies would show up to me when I would see speculative bubbles like NFTs pop, and there was all this mania over collectibles that ultimately weren't worth anything. And Jerry Springer seems like it's all around us. Even though the daytime talk format has died off, Jerry Springer lives on through reality television, through social media influencers, and in our politics. I mean, Congressman Fetterman apologized to the Springer Show for comparing Congress to Springer because he's saying that Congress is actually more lowbrow than Jerry Springer is. So I just saw these little facets of 90s culture kind of resurface in weird and unusual ways. And that made me go back and dive into the stuff that I liked as a kid. And I have a fond interest in the trashy side of stuff. So that's why I focus on that, because there's already been books about like the great pop culture, like The Sopranos and all the movies that came out in 1999. I wanted to look at pro wrestling, Jerry Springer, porn, and the Insane Clown Posse instead.
Can't I look at any year and find great examples of this low culture being embraced?
Oh, yeah, you definitely could look at any year. And you could write a similar book about 1997 or 2001. But in 99, it was just a little nuttier than usual. Part of that is due to media deregulation that was occurring throughout the 90s and even the late 80s. But media companies were always on the search for the next big thing with the youth market. A lot of stunts happened at the end of the millennium. That, like, and Jerry Springer, for instance, they would bring on women who were trying to sleep with as many people as possible in a given day. A lot of that happened in 1999, like a lot of these trashy attempts at breaking world records. You know, I just felt like 99 was a little more insane than like 97 or 98. But yeah, you can make the case for a lot of years.
What is it that we can point to in 1999 as breaking the mold? That this was like, okay, things are now going to be different, particularly going into this new century.
The stuff that would really take off was often cheaply produced for a mass audience. And this is probably best reflected in the teen movies that came out in 99. So there were probably more movies aimed at like teenagers made on a cheap budget than had ever been produced in a single calendar year. I'm thinking American Pie, She's All That, Never Been Kissed, Teaching Miss Tingle, Jawbreaker. I mean, there's a bunch of them. Throughout the 90s, especially with the Telecommunications Act in 1996, you had a lot of deregulation that allowed media companies to own various types of properties that they weren't allowed to own. Like, you know, cable companies could be phone distributors, and a broadcast network could have the same parent company as a cable company and a movie studio. All these things used to be prohibited. Now they were all allowed. And so these huge corporations, they're chasing the lowest common denominator. They're trying to make a hit for as cheaply as possible. They cut, funding for educational programming, and, you know, they funneled it into producing stuff like reality TV, which had been the sole domain of cable before. But now, you know, you had broadcast networks getting into it with deregulation. So I don't mean to say all this stuff is bad either. I was a fan of all these things. I was a fan of Insane Clown Posse. I watched Jerry Springer with my parents. Millions of people liked all of these products. So they're not putting anything out there that people don't want. But there was a heightened pressure after all those mergers, all those huge media mergers. They had the largest media merger ever in 1999 with CBS and Viacom. And the largest radio merger ever that same year, to get a hit as cheaply as they can. And, you know, a way to do that is to be crass, because what people, might think they're above, millions of others are watching.
We've had a couple of mentions of Jerry Springer. So there may be some folks out there that don't exactly know what it is that you're talking about. what is it? What do you mean by Jerry Springer? Why did he become a daytime TV's most watched program?
Yeah, so Jerry Springer tried to do a serious talk show, and it failed. He tried to talk about important issues, and no one wanted to see that. What they wanted to see was what became of the Jerry Springer Show, and that's, I'm sleeping with my stepsister. My teenage daughter is a slut and is proud of it. Ku Klux Klan members fighting black activists. You know, just bizarre. A lot of it's sexual, but not exclusively, just like a freak show. Like, Jerry Springer was, you're going to bring on four people who are all sleeping with each other, and yet they're all related. Like, that's a typical episode of the Jerry Springer Show.
Jerry Springer, they really wanted to create a conflict for spectacle's sake, didn't they?
Yeah, so Richard Dominick, the executive producer, said that the show had to be so entertaining that if you were flipping through all your cable channels with the sound off, you would go, what the hell is that? And you would stop and you would watch. You know, if you were flipping through and you saw, like, my... I'm sleeping with my stepson who became a male prostitute. Like, if that was the title of the episode and then you saw two men fighting on stage about it, you'd probably stop and watch. That was their formula. And it was very successful for a long time. Jerry Springer, he had a movie made about him in 1998. There was a book, Too Hot for TV, where the outtakes of the episodes that you could give your credit card number to and purchase for $20. That sold millions of copies. All this merch came out. He became a cultural phenomenon. He beat Oprah in the ratings. What it showed is that people really like sensation. They like being entertained. You know, Jerry Springer, what he did successfully is he didn't lecture anyone.
Well, actually, a lot of celebrities did. He did lecture people.
Well,
that was part of the show.
In the last 5 minutes, he did. He gave his final thought.
So
that's true. His final thought was, it's kind of funny when you think about the Jerry Springer final thought, because he would have the craziest stuff you've seen on broadcast television and an hour of insanity. And then he'd come at the end and be like, this is what we need to be like as a society. And like, talk like he's a pastor. That was always kind of silly.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're taking a break talking about the year of 1999. Was it a watershed year that torpedoed good taste? In 1999, Britney Spears exploded into the pop culture scene. She released her debut album, Baby One More Time, on January 12, 1999. The music video sparked controversy and cemented her both as a teen idol and a lightning rod for debate about the industry that exploited young female artists. Her 1999 debut wasn't just the birth of a pop star, but it was the start of a new era of pop culture. We'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In 1999, The Jerry Springer Show was at the peak of its popularity, drawing in nearly 7 million viewers per episode, even surpassing the Oprah Winfrey Show in some markets. It was a cultural juggernaut, dominating daytime television and becoming a symbol of the era's love of outrage, spectacle, and trash TV. The show started in 1991 as a more traditional talk show, focusing on social and political issues, and devolved into a chaotic circus by the mid-1990s. By 1999, it had perfected its formula, shocking guests and outrageous confessions, onstage brawls, and the infamous Jerry, Jerry chants from the studio audience. In his book, 1999, The Year Low Culture Conquered America and Kickstarted Our Bizarre Times, Ross Bennis breaks down the Jerry Springer Show. So he was a progressive, you know, mayor of Cincinnati.
Yeah, progressive mayor of Cincinnati, and he ran for Ohio governor, and he actually became mayor after he was forced out. He resigned from city council after it was discovered that he paid for a prostitute with a signed check. He resigned on his own and then came back and became mayor after, like, everyone already knew that scandal. So it's quite the story. He was really talented guy, but he didn't, when he would have, like, the craziest situation on his show, at, you know, they were sitting there on the platform. Aside from a few moments, like when he kind of got underneath the skin of a neo-Nazi, he normally would just let these people tell their crazy story and, you know, wouldn't judge them. He would just kind of coax their story out of them, no matter how ridiculous it sounded. And that was really appealing.
Well, how much of that was real? There's been a lot of stories of people who have come forth and said, actually, that's not really my story. I just went on Jerry Springer because I got paid.
Oh, there's definitely people who stuck through and did that. And I wouldn't put it above those producers to do something sleazy, like plant a guest if they have a shortage. But are also incidents of real people going on there for sure. I mean, some of them had altercations with the law after those episodes that you know, stemmed from the issues they were talking about. So, you know, some of those, like, crazy affairs and fights, there was real buildup with real people in them. But I don't know what share of the people are, you know, genuine guests versus plants.
Oh, welcome back. My guests today are confronting lovers who they say are cheating. Now I'd like you to meet my next guest, Mary Kay. Mary Kay, what is going on?
I've been seeing Tommy off and on for 4 years. I recently found out that he's been dogging this other hoe. He calls me off and on.
Apparently, that's how you dog a hoe. Okay, so you're saying he's, but wait a second, why do you want to be with this guy if he's obviously cheating on you, for whatever reason?
4 years is a long time, and we've been through a lot.
First, let's meet this other woman, who you call a hoe. Here is Bonnie.
So how does that connect to where we are today? We don't have Jerry Springer on right now. Is there anything comparable to that?
Well, we don't have Jerry Springer on right now, but Jerry Springer really influenced the reality TV that we know. And TV networks began producing reality shows after all that deregulation that I mentioned. Once they were able to produce their own primetime programming and sell it, that's when, like, they got into The Amazing Race and Survivor and all those franchises, Big Brother. So when you're seeing you know, all the ladies on the Real Housewives of whatever city have fights at dinner. That's a lot like Jerry Springer. The cast members arguing on Vanderpump Rules, that's a lot like Jerry Springer. The social media influencers, though, who get into spats with each other online over issues they don't even have any business really talking about, that's very Jerry Springer-like. But also, when you turn on C-SPAN and you see a member of Congress threaten to fight the Teamsters president over a congressional hearing, that's a lot like Jerry Springer, too.
People at the time were horrified and said, this is terrible and we can't do this anymore. Were they just outvoted by the eyeballs and people wanted to watch that?
That's what I would say. A lot of people said it was terrible. TV Guide said it was the worst show of all time. It was called moral rot, moral decay. They were accused of ruining the country. At the same time, they're the number one show on daytime television and they're a cultural phenomenon. So, you know, you can make a parallel to the things that a lot of people say about Trump, but he won the popular vote. You know, that that lack of pretentiousness and that ability to just drive sustained outrage and
pay off a prostitute and get away with it.
Yeah. You know, him and Jerry Springer are alike in that way, except for Jerry Springer felt guilty about it and resigned from his position. And Trump just denied that he ever did it.
So aside from Jerry Springer, there were some interesting first times in 1999 that are still with us today that I'm fascinated by. You know, SpongeBob SquarePants debuted in 1999. Family Guy also, and these are still shows today. Are these examples of our mental rot?
No. You know, SpongeBob's a beloved children's franchise. Family Guy may be coarse, but you know, I don't know if it's really a whole lot different than a continuation of The Simpsons. There was a lot of great pop culture, you know, in 1999. The West Wing debuted, Sopranos came out. There were a lot of movies that were critically acclaimed, like The Matrix. What I was thinking of more so is like, you know, like The Man Show.
What is The Man Show?
That's how Jimmy Kimmel got his start, and it's kind of how Joe Rogan became famous before Fear Factor. The Man Show was a Comedy Central show with Adam Carolla and Jimmy Kimmel. And they would be drinking, like, the whole time. It's just a bunch of guys in the audience and women, like, wearing practically nothing. And they just, like, come on and ogle, drink beers, and, you know, make profane jokes.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to cut the wife's perspective tonight. Are we a little Ziggy Socky to end the program?
Yeah!
Ziggy Socky, Ziggy Socky, hoy, hoy, hoy! Ziggy Socky, Ziggy Socky, hoy, hoy, hoy! Ziggy Socky, Ziggy Socky, hoy, hoy, hoy! Oh, my goodness!
Yes! Now we leave you with girls jumping on trampolines. Good night!
So was the idea that you just can't go wrong putting on television of that caliber?
Well, you know, and Tom Green got, you know, his first show in 1999. There was a lot of money spent marketing to the under 50 male demographic at the time. So it was believed that, you know, young people contribute more to the bottom line of a brand eventually than an older person. They have a lot of lifetime value to give to the brand. Men are making the most money, hold the most purchasing decisions. Also, most of the executives at these entertainment companies are men, you know, like 80%+ back in 1999. So an overabundance of media, especially TV shows and movies, were aimed at, you know, guys that are kind of my age now. Like, if, you know, in between high school and younger than 50, that's a lot of the stuff I'm describing here. Like, you know, Jerry Springer and pro wrestling and The Man Show, and I'd throw even the Insane Clown Posse in there, even though that's a musical group.
They were celebrating a very simplistic view of life. They weren't even thinking about life. They were just celebrating the moment.
Well, yeah, I think it's just, you know, it's a lot of programming aimed at guys that's, yeah, it's not super introspective or anything. It's just kind of like, put them up there. They'll do something outrageous, or offensive or silly. And we won't, you know, there's not a lot of money that you have to put into producing that type of program, and enough people will like it that the costs will outweigh the benefits. But not everything worked out, though. You know, there's series like Shasta McNasty got canceled. There was a lot of
explain that. What is that?
It was a sitcom on UPN. It starred Gary Busey's son, and it's just like a group of guys in their 20s who are always trying to hit on women but not having a whole lot of success, and they're like, you know, just super. There's not like a deep plot or anything to any of the episodes of Shasta McNasty.
So was there anybody saying, stop, this is we need to hit pause, this is a you know, society is can't go down this road?
Not that I'm aware of, because we did go down that road.
You know, was there some oracle saying, if you do this, you will eventually end up with someone like Donald Trump as president? And
Trump did run for his first time in 1999, which is kind of interesting.
Well, what do you mean? I mean, he didn't.
He announced he was going to run for president as part of the Reform Party in the 2000 election. It was Ross Perot's Reform Party, and then ultimately, not much came of it. But that was like the first time he put it out there that he's going to try to attempt to run for president.
And it just he didn't follow through.
Well, you know, it's a third party, and there were disputes between him and the other leaders of the Reform Party. I mean, even if they would put him on the ticket, he's not going to get, you know, more than a few percentage points. He's not going for the major party nominee at that point.
But it was just him just trying to get his name out there again.
Well, it was dismissed as a publicity stunt at the time. But now you look back and you think, was he testing the waters?
When he ran. And when he won, that was dismissed as a publicity stunt as well.
Exactly. So was he seeing how crass is the culture right now in 99? I'm sensing I could break in. Are we ready yet? He wanted to run with Oprah, was his dream. Of course, that didn't materialize, but that's what he was shooting for.
So reality, was there an attack on reality?
Oh,
like we could no longer tell what was true anymore. And this is starting to the whole idea now that we live in a post-truth world. Was this the beginning of the end of truth?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because a lot of the sci-fi of that era in particular, that's what it was all focused on. So 1999, you had The Matrix, you had Existence, Run Lola Run, The 13th Floor, all these mind-bending films where you don't know what's true and what's not. Like, that's the whole movie. Vanilla Sky came out a year later, but the original Mexican version of that film was in 99.
Blair Witch Project.
Yeah. That was in 99, too. Yeah, people thought that was real. I mean, that bended reality more than anything.
I don't know why you have to have every conversation on video.
Because we're making a documentary.
Not about us getting lost. We're making a documentary about a witch.
I know.
Lost? Admit that first.
No, I know we're not lost.
They're all over the place.
But how do we know it was people?
Well, even if it wasn't, I'm not going to play with that either.
And it's all because of me that we're here now. Hungry.
Tell me where you are, Josh!
Like, because of the marketing of it, they tried to make people think that all those kids were actually killed.
Yeah, so the whole thing about this was found footage of some kids who died in the woods, and you watch it, and the whole time they're playing with the audience's ability to discern reality.
I mean, they sent those actors away, like, to, like, hide from the public for a while so that they, you know, wouldn't be spotted at Walmart or something to ruin the facade. They had a website set up where you could find out more about the Blair Witch and research it more and, you know, learn more about the identities of these people who were killed. Of course, those people are just fictional characters, but they presented the fiction as truth, and was a very successful formula. So, you know, with the year 2000 approaching, though, that concept of what's real and what's not was debated all the time. It was debated in Congress too. Like when after Columbine and
that happened,
video games started to take the blame. Yeah, exactly. Columbine happened April 20th, 1999. Video games, by both the media and by academic researchers, were blamed, specifically the game Doom. The premise was that kids can't discern reality from unreality. The graphics of the PlayStation are so real now that when, if you're a mentally disturbed kid and you're playing a lot of first-person shooter games, you start to think that the real world is just an extension of the video game you're playing. The Truman Show came out. You have a ton of instances in the pop culture and in real life where, with the emergence of the internet in particular, and video games get more powerful, and people are just wondering what's real, what's not. We're still, though, kind of wondering that now with AI.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, back with more Ross Bennis and his book, 1999, The Year Low Culture Conquered America and Kickstarted Our Bizarre Times. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The culture of our times tells us a lot about the driving forces of what we decide to do as a society. Who do we put in office? What do we focus on? Are they the right things, wrong things? What do we value? What do we discard? The economy of 1999 was booming. The late 90s were the peak of the dot-com bubble, with the stock market, especially the NASDAQ, soaring due to speculative investments in internet companies. Unemployment was at historically low levels, around 4%. Inflation was under control. Consumer confidence was high. Wages were rising. And there was an overall sense of prosperity. This economic exuberance may have created a climate where escapist and sensationalist entertainment thrived. But there was also this sense that the good times couldn't last, and perhaps it would all come crashing down when the clock strikes midnight on December 31st, 1999. From pro wrestling and Beanie Babies to Insane Clown Posse and Jerry Springer, author Ross Bennis looks at the explosion of low culture in the mass media in the 1990s. His book is 1999, The Year Low Culture Conquered America and Kickstarted Our Bizarre Times.
In 1999, one of the big movies that came out that year was The Sixth Sense, a psychological thriller with an unforgettable twist, and I See Dead People. That also was something that played upon people's perceptions and you know, what is real, what is not. But it was a huge hit, and it's still enjoyable. It holds up great today.
Yeah, Sixth Sense is a great movie. One of the best of 1999. You know, there was a lot of great pop culture then, too. I just think the trashy side of things had a more lasting influence on us over time.
It seemed like everyone was working off the same source material. Okay, so The Sixth Sense, M. Night Shyamalan's film, highly produced and well done, but still, how far is that away from, like, the Jerry Springer Show, where, you know, we don't know who's real, what's real, and it doesn't even matter?
Well, and the concept of celebrity is changing so much at that point, because reality TV is starting to, take over the airwaves. Survivor was, you know, about to become the most watched program outside of the Super Bowl. And now, like, you have ordinary people who are famous just because they, you know, appear on a competition show.
And would eat a bug.
Would eat a bug or set something on fire, you know, do something crazy. We weren't quite prepared to how to handle those differences and delineate, what separates stardom from happenstance luck. Gosh, a crazy example that occurred in 99. There were guests on the Jenny Jones Show. One guest murdered another after their segment. And the resulting murder trial took place in 99. And it was broadcast on Court TV. And
to set it up, though, one of the guests was brought on. So he was going to meet the person who had a secret crush on him. And he wasn't aware that it was his friend who was a same sex, and it was a gay crush. And he felt that he was humiliated on national television, and then a murder was committed.
Now, which of these ways would you choose to reveal your secret crush on someone? A, would you write that person a letter? B, would you tell the person in private in case he rejects you? Or C, would you tell that person that you're gay and you hope he is on national television?
reaching out to meet Donna and Scott. Now, Donna has been helping Scott pursue his secret crush on John. John's backstage. He can't hear us. How bad's the crush? Tell me about the first time you met him. Where was he?
He was under a car working on her brake line.
Yeah. And that was your first time? What was your first impression?
I only saw the lower half of him, so you can imagine.
Did you think Donna had the crush on you?
Did I? No, we're good friends.
Well, guess what? It's Scott that has the crush on you.
You lied to me.
It's like a homophobic rage murder. And that the murder trial, so the murderer goes to jail, then there's a trial afterwards, and the victim's family is blaming the Jenny Jones Show for setting up this ambush and causing the murder. But the reason I'm bringing this up is because the people who are involved with that trial, especially the lawyer, Jeffrey Feiger, become celebrities in their own right. Not to the degree of like the O.J. Simpson trial, but like you're seeing people become famous just because they're attached to, like, they're not even like the main actors in this lawsuit. They're just attached to it. But because it's on television, they're like reality stars because people are watching them every night, even though they're just prosecutors. So, you had a whole new line of celebrities emerging in the 90s. And now, of course, everyone thinks we're celebrities. All you need is a YouTube channel or a microphone and TikTok, and you can pretend you're a celebrity to all your friends, and half of them will probably believe you.
Andy Warhol was right. We're all going to be famous in the future. Was that seemed like a signpost moment that maybe things had gone too far?
Yeah, for most TV shows, that was a signpost. For most talk shows, that was like a signpost moment. Things gone too far. A lot of talk shows dialed back, like the ambush tactics, dialed back the outrageousness, but Jerry Springer didn't. Jerry Springer did not change their format, even though they were being blamed for it as if it occurred on their program, because you could certainly imagine something like that happening from the Jerry Springer Show. They just continued doing their same style of show, and people kept watching it. So they separated themselves a little bit from the pack, because before that, a lot of the shows, even some of the more respectable shows, were trying crazy stunts to try to compete with Springer, but they ultimately dialed it back. Donahue said he was going to air a live execution, but then he was prohibited. But there was a guy in death row. Donahue wanted to air his execution as a protest, but it was seen more as voyeuristic than being something done in goodwill.
Well, the argument was that if more people could witness an execution, then maybe they would be opposed to the death penalty.
That's what he's saying. It's going to show how barbaric it is. But I bet the TV network executives are saying, well, this would we're going to get people to watch. I mean, that would have broke records if that would have been allowed. It would have been a moral scandal.
The confusion between entertainment and reality even reached into the world of politics, particularly with Bill Clinton.
In 99, you have the impeachment wrapping up of Clinton and lying about his sexual infidelities with Monica Lewinsky. That's like a tabloid scandal on par with, the Lolita of Long Island. The way that was handled, in the press and even by just Americans, the way we talked about it, it was treated as like a schlocky tabloid.
Everyone knew the name Joey Buttafuoco. That was, he tried to cash in on his infamy. But the testimony that came out from the Clinton impeachment, it read like a hot copy from any one of these really racy daytime TV shows.
Well, so what's interesting about that is that there were laws in the late 90s that were passed to try to prevent, there were porn regulation laws. A lot of them were aimed at like children accessing porn online. And these laws were ultimately struck down for being overbroad. And one of the arguments that was successfully made was that the way all these laws defined pornography would have prohibited someone from 18, under 18, from reading the Star report about the Clinton affair.
The Ken Starr.
Because it was so steamy. Yeah.
Ken Starr, the special prosecutor appointed to investigate Clinton. And later on, we learned a lot more about the hypocrisy behind all that.
So, but the Starr report by Ken Starr investigating Bill Clinton, there are scenes in there where getting pizza together, and then that leads to like a tryst between them. So anyone putting that material online, as these late 90s laws were defined, it would have been deemed as sexual content that would have needed to be regulated. And yet this is like a government sanctioned report on the president. So that's, you know, a small reason why several of those laws were struck down by the Supreme Court, because it's really tough to set a standard that's content based without going overbroad and, you know, bringing down protected speech that would have otherwise been fine.
And people's right to know what the president is doing in the Oval Office. Are we looking back with nostalgia on 1999? Is that this was a golden age of coarse culture? Are we trying to elevate it, or what are you trying to do?
I might be a little nostalgic here. I was 10 years old in 1999, and I liked all these topics that we are talking about. But what I'm trying to do, I don't know if I'll be successful or not, is show people that the entertainment that's considered trashy, or that's called throwaway pop culture, that often reflects our world just as much as all the great stuff. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion about how all these great movies from 1999, like The Matrix and Sixth Sense, how they influenced filmmaking, and how shows like The Sopranos, you know, had an impact on our broader society. But my point is that the Insane Clown Posse and Jerry Springer and early internet porn affected our culture too, and in some ways affected it more so than all the stuff that got the rave headlines. So, you know, you can dismiss something that's lowbrow all you want, but if millions of people are really into it and engaging with it for years, it's going to leave an imprint, and others will find what they did successfully and bring that into their own formula.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The conversation with Ross Bennis continues. His book is 1999, The Year Low Culture Conquered America and Kickstarted Our Bizarre Times. We'll be right back. This is The Source from Texas Public Radio with David Martin Davies. The year 1999 was the year pop culture was living the crazy life. Living La Vida Loca by Ricky Martin was released that year, and it was a global hit. The song was a major part of the Latin pop explosion of the late 1990s, helping to mainstream Latin music in the U.S. But on television, 1999, there was an explosion of what was called moral rot. Ross Bennis has written the book, 1999, The Year Low Culture Conquered America and Kickstarted Our Bizarre Times. Obviously, 1999 was the year of Y2K. The world was freaking out over whether or not every computer is going to crash on January 1st of 2000. People stockpiled canned foods and water, and they were really hunkering down, getting ready for societal collapse. This impending sense of doom that we were approaching the end of the millennium, end of the century. Do you think that had anything to do with any of this?
A little bit. So just to give you one small example, I have a chapter on Beanie Babies because like people just went mad over Beanie Babies in the late 90s and spent tons of money on a product that ultimately had, you know, no value.
And these were like animals or teddy bears that were filled with plastic beads, kind of cute, but, you know, they weren't worth hundreds of dollars.
Yeah, they're $5 plushy toys that people thought they could hoard and pay for their children's education with. Like, they would make, you know, $100,000 saving a closet full of Beanie Babies. Instead, they just, you know, kept dumping their money. The resale value kept going up. The reason I bring them up is because Ty Warner, founder and creator of Beanie Babies, said he was going to retire them all on December 31st, 1999. that there was going to be this extinction of Beanie Babies. And what he wanted to do is get everyone to go out there and buy more shortly after, say, well, we're not really retiring them. We're going to have new Beanie Babies. We're just getting rid of, you know, those specific ones. He was able to push that story because of that sense of doom. Like, December 31st, 1999 was a good time to pull a stunt like that. It was a good time to, you know, push something kind of crazy. You got to get them in now before it all ends. There was this thing called We Live in Public, where this artist, there's a documentary about it, where this artist who made millions through the dot-com bubble basically used a lot of his money and had dozens of people living in this huge underground terrarium in New York City. Almost seems kind of culty, and he was filming everything that they were doing and broadcasting it, and that was a Y2K thing. Like, he did that because we're going to do it for the end of the millennium. MTV had the Bunker Project, where they would film people in the bunker, and it was kind of zany. They had some silly promos, but there's just a lot of these little examples where people would play on that sense of, like, they don't really believe a doomsday is going to happen, but we're going to kind of buy into it anyways, like a pro wrestling story. Like, we're just going to kind of pretend this is real for the sake of entertainment. And that makes it more fun for us to do something outrageous at the end of the year. And I think there was more outrageousness on December 31st, 1999 than there is in probably any single date in modern history. There's also more movies and TV shows that take place on that particular date too. There's like 75 different TV shows and movies that take place on that singular day and time. People find it really fascinating.
They find what they, that December 31st.
Yeah. December 31st, 1999 / January 1st, 2000. That's the setting for like a ton of shows and movies even. And a lot of them weren't made in 99. Like, some of them are still being made today. Like that movie Y2K, that was just produced by A24. But you could go back, like Strange Days. That was a movie made in 95. That's about New Year's Eve, 1999.
I mean, and we're talking about 25 years ago. And there are quite a bit of our population. They weren't born even at that time now. Now they're in their early 20s, and do they look at 1999 as a magical time that it's like, well, that would have been really cool to live at that time?
You know, I'm not sure how like teenagers look at it right now. They might just, maybe I'm an old boomer at this point to them for putting all this focus on 99, like the way my dad would talk about.
You're not
Woodstock.
A boomer.
I'm not a boomer. That's what I'm saying.
You're too young.
That's why they, that's probably how I'm perceived by people of that generation. Because my dad, who's actual boomer, like he talks about like the Woodstock era the way I talk about 99. Because, you know, that's the age gap for us. But pop culture does run on nostalgia cycles of 25 to 30 years. You know, if you look at Back to the Future or Happy Days or Grease, if you project that out forward, we're in that time now for the late 90s.
But you're saying we need to look back in the golden age of trash culture, the coarsening of America, that we had this the dominoes were falling, and this was a key time for that.
Yeah, definitely. And I try to not be too nostalgic despite my own pop cultural preferences. I was on a podcast like 2 weeks ago, and someone was saying like the 90s are so peaceful and great compared to now. And I'm like, well, not if you read the books and the news articles from the 90s. They thought it was as bad as we think it is now.
It's very naive. I go back and I read and it says, oh, what a quaint time. They thought that was bad. I have news for them.
Like, if you read like any of the coverage of the Communications Decency Act, that was put forth in the 90s, and like the anxiety behind those debates, that they were as unsure about their time as we are now with like with AI and TikTok. Like, they had their own debates of things they wanted to censor and regulate. You know, after Columbine, like how many facets of pop culture were blamed for kids killing other kids? You know, really tough time. If you listen to music of your favorite band from the 90s, they're like, oh, those are awesome times. A lot of terrible things happened that people were upset and anxious about. Jerry Springer was really popular, but he was also really hated.
He was held up as an example of what not to be.
By the way, reality and unreality, just to go back to something we were talking earlier, Garth Brooks did his Chris Gaines thing in 99. He had a country star pretending to be a pop star, and it didn't go over well, so then they just pretended like it never happened, and you can't find that music like hardly anywhere now. But he had a behind this music documentary made about his fictional pop star that he was a sex addict from Australia, and he went through all these like terrible things as a kid. Really little quirky piece of American music history there.
And there was this Backstreet Boys versus NSYNC feud at that time. These two late 90s boy bands, they were dropping really successful albums and apparently having some sort of conflict with each other. Was that real, or were the fans?
Yeah, so they were, they've had the same mastermind behind both groups, Lou Pearlman, who is now in jail. Like, he's a Ponzi schemer and a felon, and like there's a lot of bad stuff out there about him now. So it was manufactured by Lou Pearlman to sell records, to have this beef. But I've also watched documentaries where both those bands talk about it, and for a while they did dislike each other, but it's because they were being pitted against each other by the same guy. But eventually,
that falls into that whole thing too about what was real, what was not, what was manufactured, what was presented as authentic.
Yeah,
you couldn't even, the lines were blurred.
It sounds like we're talking about pro wrestling when you, trying to figure out what's real and what's authentic and what's scripted and what's not. The Backstreet Boys and NSYNC definitely, the fans definitely bought into it. And maybe that matters more than if the band themselves did.
When you say they bought into it, it means they paid money into it.
Oh, yeah. They would pay money because I'm a Backstreet fan, not an NSYNC fan. I'm going to show that by buying the Millennium album, even though they have the same record company and the same manager, so my money's going to the same place, ultimately.
What do you think are the big lessons? I mean, here we are, 25 years later. What are the big lessons?
I would say if you're looking at like Jerry Springer and the reality television that came from him, he demonstrates how attention is such an effective way to gain power, even if there's not a lot of substance below it. If you're talking about, the panic of Columbine and video games being blamed, every generation has their scapegoat, really, and it's often whatever the kids are using that the adults aren't yet familiar with. Video games went through what movies and TV did before it. Beanie Babies, I mean, geez, some Pete's. You saw people fall for a scheme and, kind of illustrate some of the vulnerabilities of capitalism.
NFTs or the cyber coins?
Yeah, NFTs are the new Beanie Babies. People are dumping money into them because they think everyone else is dumping money into them, and then it turns out there's not a whole lot there, not much to collect on. And then just two others. So pro wrestling popularity peaked in the 90s. You had 10 hours of programming from WWE and WCW watched by 30 million people. It was just so huge. And they basically got people to buy into, whatever they're doing. And the concept of pretending that something is real when it isn't bled into society, like, around that time. So it's called kayfabe. So when Trump says that he's going to make Canada the 51st state, that's kind of kayfabe. Like, no one thinks he's really going to do that. But if you like him, you follow it anyways, because it's more fun to just buy into it.
Is that short for something, or what does that come from?
It's like a carnival term. Yeah, it's not short for anything.
It's like when I used to go to the freak show and I'd see the lady in the bikini turn into a gorilla. That's what it was.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's more fun to buy into that. So that concept is kind of all around us now. It just shows like propaganda is pretty effective if it's unnoticed. If you're not questioning it, you just kind of go along with it. That's how a wrestling storyline gets sold. That's how a lot of political storylines get sold. The main takeaway would just be that cultural symbolism isn't limited to like the highbrow stuff like Shakespeare, the Great Gatsby. We can learn a lot about ourselves and about our society if we pay close attention to entertainment that other people may consider trashy.
Ross Bennis is the author of 1999, the year low culture conquered America and kickstarted our bizarre times. That's it for this edition of The Source. You can find us wherever you get cool podcasts and look for us also on YouTube. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.